Hi, you are welcome to Health Talks with your man, Kobe Blay. In this episode, I bring you up close with a recovering drug addict who shares his experience on how he managed to earn a PhD in alcoholism and drug abuse, 19 years from the streets and ghettos of Accra. A counselor, advocate, and a motivational speaker, let's meet our guest, Mr. Richard Opari.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, you interestingly or jokingly refers to yourself as having earned a PhD in drug use. And how did you earn this?
Kobe, I earned it in a very hard way. And I think I had my brush with drugs, like you've rightly introduced or said so far. It all started at age 14. And when I first had my first drug, and the first drug I came in contact or had an encounter with was alcohol. I used alcohol at the age of 14. I think at that time, I was so curious and I wanted to find out what was actually in the bottle. And the first time I used alcohol, I really loved it. You know, the feeling, the euphoria and all of that. And that gave me a sense of wanting to always feel like having it one more time. So it went on and on and on, and I did that for 6 years. And after 6 years, and then I had finished my secondary education in a way, because as I speak to you now, if there's anything I'm struggling and still struggling with, it has to do with my education. And I keep saying that is one thing I may go back for, you know, and pick it up. So at that time, then I was 20 years, and then I met these friends who actually did the things I couldn't do. They had the confidence, proposed to the ladies, and you know, all sort of things like that. And then most of the time, I'm somebody who had always been wanting to find out, or you know, I'm so adventurous, okay, so to speak. Yeah. And wanted to find out why they could confidently do the things that I had always wanted to do so at ease. So by virtue of some investigation, I realized that they were on some substance, some whitish something, you know. So
now, after the 6 years,
that was after the 6 years of my, you know, alcohol encounter, or my alcohol, you know, my issue with alcohol. I felt like wanting to know what they were actually doing as far as that whitish thing was concerned. In fact, at that time, this time it's white, but at that time that I started using those substances, it was in the brown form.
Okay.
You know, and I'm referring to heroin.
Oh, okay.
And I took to heroin. And one of the things that made me fall in love with heroin at the time was that, first of all, it doesn't produce any odor. Okay. I mean, it's odor free or scent free. So you take an unlike alcohol where people smell it on you and other things like that. This time you take it, you are normal, you okay. know. So I actually fell in love with heroin. Two, I also realized that heroin gave me the confidence, the ability to speak to people without fear. So these are some of the benefits I had, in quotes, from the use of heroin. I also had that euphoria, the pleasure, you know, the kind of feeling. In fact, I don't even have the adjective for which I used to describe the kind of feeling I had as a result, you know, what I had from the use of heroin. But it produced some kind of feeling. It gives that kind of benefit where, you know, sexual benefit, okay, benefit in terms of the ability to speak to people without having to be afraid, irrespective of who the person is, and so on and so forth. So I sort of fell in love with it at age 20. And other substances also came in, like cocaine, marijuana, and of course cigarettes. So apparently for 19 years, just as you said, I did about 5 drugs.
And that started all with alcohol.
It started with alcohol. So alcohol was more like a gateway drug.
Okay.
It opened the gate for other drugs to come in. Within a period of 19 years, I was hooked to all these drugs. And there was no single time. In fact, I fell in love with all these drugs so much that there was no single time that I cheated on any of them. I made sure that I always satisfy or, you know, choke myself with these drugs as a way of getting the operi going.
Okay.
You know, because at a point, and in the absence of these drugs, I felt lonely, I felt sad, I felt as if I had been divorced, you know, and so on. So I use these drugs for pleasure. But let me just chip in this, that the latter part of my drug use, which will come there anyway, wasn't pleasurable any longer, like it used to be from the beginning. Initially, it was cool, so pleasurable, and I would use it and keep using simply because I wanted to have that euphoria, that feelings, and so on and so forth. But at a point, during the latter part of my drug use, I felt that I wasn't actually using for pleasure, but I was using for survival.
Okay, so in the earlier stages when you were enjoying the effects of the drug you were using, now you went to a state where you just needed to survive.
Yes, I got to a stage where I needed to survive. In fact, let me say that at a point when I started, technically now I've come to know that I was using because it was my mind, the euphoria that was getting me to go use.
Okay.
But at the point where I got hooked to, in other words, when I became addicted to these drugs, I actually wasn't going to use for pleasure, but using for survival, in the sense that at this point, in the absence of the drugs, I went into withdrawal.
Okay.
And what I mean by withdrawal is that I'm referring to that physical traumatic condition which you find yourself when you don't have the drugs. And typical examples are the headache you experience, the joint pains.
That is when you are not using.
When you are not using.
Okay.
And the use of drugs at the point of addiction is such that after every 8 hours, you need to top up. It's just like using a mobile phone where you always have to top up with your with the credit, you know, airtime. At every 8 hours, you need to top up. Otherwise, then the withdrawal sets in. And the withdrawal is, like I've said earlier, the physical traumatic condition where you feel the headache, you feel the joint pain, the stomach cramps, you know, the runny nose, and all these discomforts come simultaneously. So it isn't as if you have headache, it goes, the stomach cramps comes, it goes, the joint pains, and so on. But simultaneously, you face all these conditions.
All together.
And one interesting thing that makes one goes deeper, like in my case, went deeper, was that it's so traumatic that the only thing that takes away this pain is the same drug that has created the pain.
Okay, so if I have to understand, that at the point when this drug was dropping you, it was failing you, you could find yourself in trouble. It was this same drug that had to relieve you of that stress, that pain.
That pain.
So that is why you describe it as your point of survival. The drug gave you survival.
Yes, it makes you survive. So drug had now become, at that point, a two-edged sword.
Okay.
It destroys and repairs. You know, it destroys and repairs. So the same drug that created the pain, this uneasiness, the joint pains, the headache, the withdrawal, which we call the techie, techie on the street, is the same drug that eases the pain. You know, so it means that at that point, then it had become necessary for me to continue to use. It wasn't as if I didn't know the consequence this time around. I knew that the drugs were actually slowly killing me. In other words, I was using these drugs to commit suicide slowly, but it had become a means of survival.
Okay.
In other words, without them or without these drugs, I was going to actually
die. With the drugs, what were you able to do? Were you able to achieve what really... Can you give us some scenarios?
Well, you know, the misconception I had, you know, from the initial stages when I started using these drugs was that when you use these drugs, you'll be smart, you know, academically you'll be excellent.
And did it help you one way or the other?
Like I'm saying, academically I'm a flop. You know, I'm a flop. And let's say sexually, you know, the drugs are so cunning. You know, when you start using drugs, until some time you might think that it's solving the problems for which you started using. Right. And let's say sex. When you take the drugs, it sells more like an aphrodisiac.
Okay.
It gives you the ability to boost your sexual, you know, strength and so on. And let me just register here, and that for anybody who is listening to this interview should be very circumspect, because I'm not mentioning that if it boosts your sexual ability, then some people will be so curious and wanting to find out whether it's true or not. Because at the end of the day, the same drug that gave you the boost will take away the power or the strength. So because look, at a point in time I thought I had gone out of men. What I mean by that was that at a point I wasn't even getting erection anymore.
Oh,
I wasn't getting erection.
The same thing
that gave me the power, the ability, and that made my numerous girlfriends enjoyed me. That same thing eventually took away the power, the ability.
Okay.
Right. Mm. So yes, initially it's as if it's solving the problem. Initially it's as if it's giving you all the ability, the strength, the whatever you're looking for which you started using. But subsequently, it flops you. It makes you useless, and then it takes away, it compounds your problem, in short.
Mm.
It doesn't make you achieve anything. Because let me tell you, when I started using marijuana, the first time I used marijuana,
how was it like?
It was so interesting.
Mm.
I used marijuana the first time, and I heard a voice. In the course of the using, I hadn't even finished the one row.
Oh, okay.
In the course of the using,
Where were you taking this?
In the ghetto, you know, I was led to the ghetto by a friend who wrapped. I didn't know how to wrap then. He wrapped the marijuana and then put fire in it, like we say, let the fire be in it, and then put one or two and give me.
Okay.
I just smoked marijuana in those days as if I was smoking cigarettes. I was a novice. I didn't know how to actually use, you know. So I kept pulling and pulling and pulling, and at the time it was as if my mouth was choked. So I realized that something was actually happening to me.
Mm.
I left them, I dropped it, ran home, sat in a room alone. Unfortunately, I was in a room alone. And then
Were your parents by then?
My parents were around. My father died very early.
Okay.
And leaving my mother. My mother was the good mother everybody can think of. And she was around, but she didn't have any knowledge about drugs. And we're brought up, you know, in a Christian way. So it was presumed that we knew what we needed to do as far as our growing was concerned.
But at that point where you were going, you managed to get to the ghetto. Do you think something failed of parenting?
Well, they played their part. They did what they could.
Okay.
You know, I have always said as a Christian that there's no perfect parent.
Okay.
You know, and there's no perfect parenting.
Okay.
That is what I believe. Because anytime people get their children or their children get into drugs, parents sometimes blame themselves, irrespective or in spite of all what they had or they have given, you know, out.
Okay.
They feel that they didn't give much. They feel that they are the cause of it and so on and so forth. But there is something that actually gets me to understand that there is no perfect parenting.
Okay.
And that is, for those of you listening, if you are so biblical or so those Christians listening to us, or even if you are not Christian, you know what happened to Eve, Adam and Eve, you know, and the perfect parent, God.
Yeah.
They disappointed God for going to eat the apple.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to say that God is not a good parent?
Mm.
No, we know God is a perfect parent, you know, and most of the time when we feel as parents, we go to God and ask for direction.
Yeah.
But even God was disappointed.
Yeah.
You know. So there's no perfect parent. But
so let's get back to when you first used. You had to rush home. You felt.
Yeah. So I got home and the voice audibly communicated to me, told me that I should remove all my clothing, and then get on the street and start running. And that was the day that I saw that one could easily smoke and go mad. I am very fortunate, I keep saying, I give thanks to God for not going mad that day. Because everything that happened that day was a clear indication that I had gone mad.
What time was it in the part of the
day? It was hot afternoon, around 2 o'clock, 2 p.m. 2 p.m. It was hot afternoon. And I started pitying myself that, I have gone mad. You know, then I began thinking that where would the Noah's Ark be by now? A whole lot of funny ideas or thoughts started.
You're thinking about Noah's Ark.
Noah's Ark after the flood. Where would the Ark be by now? By this time, it's still intact or is destroyed somewhere. You know, and I was sharing this particular one in one of our counseling sections, and one guy said that he experienced the same thing. For him, he saw Moses with a rod about to divide the sea into two.
Oh, wow.
So these are some of the hallucinations that we experience as a result of the use of drugs.
But eventually you got used to it.
Eventually I got used to it. You know, when I share this with other guys, you know, who actually, I would say, had gotten deep into marijuana and who had experience as far as the use of marijuana was concerned or is concerned, told me that I didn't use it the way I was supposed to use it. And normally in the ghetto, people will come up with all sort of philosophies and ways to use drugs appropriately. So they told me that by the way they look at it, the best way to use it is to mix marijuana, the leaf, with some tobacco, and, you know, it will be milder for me to, you know. And I did, and it worked in a way.
So after day one, now you were progressing.
So I was progressing. It was now becoming something I did daily in order to have the appetite to eat, you know, in order to be able to face life on life terms, because having not been able to complete my school as I actually wanted to, now I needed to live anyway. I needed to survive. You know, life had become something at that age, 20, 21, 22. So life was bashing.
Okay.
And I felt that using drugs were, in those days, were actually producing some results, you know. But little did I know that it wasn't the right result.
Okay.
But then it was going to end me somewhere bad.
Okay, so did you do the heroin before the marijuana?
Yes, I started with heroin. From alcohol, I was introduced to heroin, marijuana, cocaine.
Why did you move from heroin to marijuana?
I didn't move. It wasn't as if I stopped heroin and I moved to marijuana. I was so curious. You know, as somebody who was so adventurous, so to speak, I wanted to find out everything. You know, it was difficult for you to communicate or say to me X, Y, Z for me to easily grab and then take it. You know, I always wanted to find out why it is A, B, or C. Right? So I wanted to find out. The heroin didn't do that to me.
Okay.
So I thought that marijuana was the same. It was going to take me cool. Cocaine was going to take me cool, and so on and so forth. So gradually, but like you say, it is, with time I got used to it, and then I fell in love with these drugs.
Okay. So when did you move to cocaine too?
It was within a short time. Within a year, I had graduated from heroin, marijuana, cocaine, cigarette.
Wow.
Within a year.
But you were having problem with life. Life was bashing you. So how were you able to make an income to purchase all this?
Drugs are always free to start with. Let me mention this, and I want to emphasize that there is nobody who starts using drugs and gets these substances with his own money. It starts by getting it free. And the truth of the matter is that even this time as we speak, drugs are very expensive. Basically, drugs are expensive. It's a very a high kind of lifestyle, so to speak. But there is always somebody somewhere, somehow, who is ready to give you drugs for free to start with.
Why?
Yeah, why? Because I don't know whether they still want more people to join in the drug world. And I don't know. It's quite difficult for me to even explain now why.
Okay.
But for some reason, it's always free to start with.
You ever give free drug to anyone?
Well, for me, let me just say this to you, that there's something about me in the course of my use that I think that a lot of people didn't realize, but I felt it alone. I felt that I had gotten myself hooked to drugs and that it wasn't doing me good. And for some reason, I didn't want anybody to be like me. I didn't want anybody to start, let alone get hooked to it.
So you didn't make
it. So I gave free drugs to people, you know, who were already addicted.
But,
I don't remember I introduced anybody to drugs.
Okay.
I don't remember. Yes, for free. And for the free thing I'm talking about, I used drugs for 2 years, almost free.
Someone.
All these drugs, I get the sponsorship, I get the supply for about 2 years for almost free because I had a source. I had cousins, I had friends mm-hmm. who were traveling, who were bringing these drugs into the system,
okay.
You know, from Brazil, mm-hmm. you know, Mexico, Colombia, Cochabamba, mm-hmm. India, and other places you can think of. So for 2 years, I was getting these drugs for free.
Mm-hmm.
It was when the source blocked, by way of, you know, getting them arrested one way or the other,
oh, okay.
That was when I saw the ugly side of drugs. This time around, I had to buy with my money. This time around, I had to sell my properties. Did I even have properties? But, you know, one or two things that I had.
Selling the petty things.
The petty things I had. And when I had exhausted the things I had by way of selling, now I had to steal from my parents. I had to steal from anywhere available, you know, that I could lay hands on, anything I could lay hands on, to get out there to satisfy this disease called addiction.
So it was not that you just enjoyed or you just wanted to steal or rob or something?
No. I was a very good boy, brought up in a Christian home. I knew how bad or what the scriptures say about stealing.
Okay.
You know, I knew everything, but, you know, addiction is such that it's not about knowing or no knowing. The most important thing is that you need to satisfy that baby born called addiction. You need to satisfy that disease called addiction.
Mm.
So you do everything necessary to get the drugs, even the things you hate to do.
Mm.
So I hated stealing, I hated lying, I hated all the things that I had to do to get drugs to continue using. But I didn't have any option than to do them.
If you could, can you tell us, was there any worst incidents you don't even want to remember?
Mm.
Just say, for the interview sake, you tell us, was there any situation that whenever it flashes in your mind, like you deeply, deeply regret it, that was due to the drug?
Easy. Kobe, and this is a very tough question.
Yeah.
At a point, despite the fact that I do advocacy, that there are times that I share my life experience, there are times that I teach on drugs, I do training programs on drug abuse, addiction, and other things like that, substance abuse in general. When it comes to this particular question, I find it very difficult because there's always something within me that tells me not to get myself back into those days.
Mm.
I hate the flashbacks.
Mm.
But like you rightly have said, for the sake of this interview, I had a girlfriend I so much loved. She was my classmate. I love this girl so much. In fact, like we say in our ordinary native language, that air was not passing between the two of us.
Oh, interesting.
And, yes, and we were so much in love. And what even brought us together the more was when I even started using the drugs. She didn't know, but I was using the drugs on her. In other words, I was using the drug to satisfy her sexually, and she felt that perhaps it was my natural strength, but I was borrowing the strength somewhere. But
how come she couldn't get it?
Yeah, she couldn't get it. I mean, when you're in love, sometimes you go blind.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm sure she was blind then. She had fallen. And I would always steal from this girl. You know, sometimes she would come to me, I'll steal her money and use it on drugs. And at a point, she'll be crying and crying because she's hungry. And at a point, when she got to know finally, I even broke the news to her that I was on drugs. And it was something I did to her. She had to take me to hospitals upon hospitals. She did everything she could at the age of about 20.
Hmm.
You know, and she stretched so much that today when I have that flashback, when I think of it, the kind of thing that I took her through. And there's something I want to tell you. This girl loved me so much that I'm sure that if I had attempted to introduce her to drugs, I would have succeeded.
Hmm.
Yes. But thank God, I was so charitable at that time that I didn't think of a thing like that.
Okay.
Today she's married. I'm so grateful.
Mm.
I'm so happy. I'm married a beautiful woman. You know, I'm fortunate to always have all the beautiful women. You know, or come across all the beautiful women. A beautiful woman with three beautiful children.
Yeah.
And I'm doing well myself now.
Sure.
And I think that. And I'm doing advocacy.
Yeah.
The first phase of my program, my NGO, you know about it,
yeah.
has to do with the advocacy. The second phase, which is coming up soon or coming on soon has to do with rehabilitation. So I'm considering the rehabilitation too. One unique thing about my wife is that she understands what I'm doing. Okay. She's so supportive, and I've told her almost everything about what I used to be.
My history,
you know. So it's more like if somebody breaks it, it's like, I know already, don't tell me. You know. So that's one unique thing about my wife. I love her so much. And I think that she's been my backbone. She's been so supportive, you know. And then the advocacy is going on, well, except that, you know, what has to do with money, which is the main problem, you know. Sponsorship funding is one problem. But God is seeing us through. God is seeing us through. We've come so far. I think that we registered our NGO somewhere 2008. Mm. It's been running for the past 6 years.
Okay.
And I must say that we've spoken to close to about 100,000 people already.
Very well. We'll still get more people whilst they are listening to us here, and then and get back to what you are doing.
Mm.
But at what tipping point did you think, well, you need a solution, and how did it happen? How did you move away from your worst situation?
Good. So my entire drug life was 19 years. 6 years was alcohol. Right, 13 years was on harder drugs.
Mm.
Alcohol is a hard drug,
yeah.
But I call other drugs harder drugs.
Okay,
that is my perspective. That's how I look at it. Now, 11 years out of this 13 was a struggle period. I struggled for 11 years to come out of drugs. It wasn't so easy. I had been to all the rehabilitation centers you can think of. Right now, the turning point, at the point I was using drugs and praying to die somewhere.
You wanted to die?
Yes, I wanted to die. I didn't have the guts, the strength. My strength to take my own life or commit suicide was so feeble. So I was praying gradually that somewhere, somehow, some way, I would just die. You know, because for me at that time, I thought that it was impossible for anybody to stop using drugs once you have started. Right. So the turning point was so interesting. I met this friend called Isa, a Muslim who had stopped. In fact, I wouldn't say stopped, paused. Because there are times in our using that we pause. You know, about a week or two, then we get back into business, you know.
Mm.
So he had paused a little, and then I met with him. He told me that the only way I could stop using drugs was to be up at midnight, do alwala, and pray to Allah. I didn't understand what all these meant, but what I understood at that point by my background as a Christian was to seek the face of God.
Well.
So I did what he said, got up midnight.
But why did you wanted to stop?
I wanted to stop. I was so desperate. I wanted to stop. But I had done everything. Changed the time of drinking, reduced the quantity of stuff, you know, changed the friends, changed the ghettos, you know.
Now who told you about that?
These were personal efforts, personal, you know, innovations, you know, changing all these things, trying everything. It wasn't working, right? So when I met this guy and introduced this concept, I felt that let me try it. Although I was waiting to die, let me just try this concept. So I got up as he had prescribed, midnight, and then I'll go and pray. I didn't even know what I was saying, but I will always ask God to help me out of this situation, and that I was going to be a servant. I was going to be, if he pleases him, he should use me as a mouthpiece to let people understand the dangers involved in the use of drugs and all of that. Now, I did this for about a week or two. Then I fell sick. Right? When I fell sick, I continued praying. I remember in my sick bed, I told God that it wasn't sickness I wanted. I wanted to stop using drugs. But you know, God has a way of, you know, getting people or one out of a problem.
Mm.
And I've said time and again in our counseling section, in my advocacy, I say, if you're a drug addict and you find yourself in prison or police cells, it could be that is where God wants, or the means that God wants to use to take you out of drugs. Make the best use of that moment. So I fell sick for about a week. And in my sickness, in the days I was using actively, I would still take the medication and use drugs. Because I couldn't stand the symptoms of malaria and then the symptoms of drugs withdrawal. I couldn't. So I would take the malaria medication, all right, and come back to use the drugs.
Whilst you were praying?
Well, no. I mean, before I started this praying exercise.
Okay.
So anytime I felt sick in those days, I did this.
But whilst I was praying and I fell sick, I was still using the same medium, using the drugs and taking the medication at the same time. But this time, anytime I took the drugs, and I mean the narcotic drugs, I felt as if I was going to die. I felt dizziness, and as if the room in which I was sitting was going round, and I was on three occasions rushed to the emergency ward. You know, it was then that
on what account?
You know, I didn't know. I occasionally will go off. You know, should I say, call it collapse? Go off. And I didn't know where I was. By the time I knew, I was in emergency ward. You know, so it was on this occasion that I felt that no, the time had come. I had that feeling, that inner feeling that it was time to stop using drugs. And it was so easy, because in the use of drugs, there's something we call obsession.
Yeah.
Obsession is the thought of the use of the drugs. In fact, the thought to use the drugs will come. It kept coming. Oh, get up, go use just one thought, just one booster, you know, just one rock. And it kept coming. But I told myself that I would die if I continue. Then I had a dream. In the dream, I saw somebody dead. And then I heard a voice in the dream that told me that if you go use back drugs again, you are going to die like this person. And that was the turning point. And I thought that, well, physically I was getting better with the days that I spent in the hospital. And so if I was getting better and with this dream, then let me do something about it. For about a year, I was struggling with drugs. This time, although I wasn't using this time around, I started fellowshipping with churches and, you know, trying to get the gospel and stuff like that. I would say that the gospel helped me.
But for me, in the course of the use of your drugs, the active usage period, were you able to go to church?
No. I was invited on several occasions to go to church, but anytime I went, it was because of what I would get from the person who invited me.
And that is
money.
And so, what do you use the money for?
So you need to give me my transport to the church and transport back home. I didn't honor invitation to church where you are going to be the one to pick me from the house and bring me back home. No. If you give me the money to the church and then knowing very well that after closing I'll get something from you back home, then I'll come.
Mm.
You know, but it wasn't a serious church going or attendance. It wasn't something serious. But this time around, I was getting serious gradually with God. And as a Christian, I'm so confident and I'm so proud to be a Christian, so to speak. I'm not trying to say that if you are not a Christian, you can't recover from drugs. In my counseling section, which is a universal thing, non-religious, I have seen people who are not Christians but who are recovering, provided they believe in a higher power. And we believe the higher power to be God.
Okay.
So I believe that once you lean on God, you are going to recover. It doesn't really matter where you are coming from or your religious affiliation.
Mm.
But as a Christian, I believe that what has brought me thus far and what has made me strong is my affiliation or my beliefs as, you know, a Christian. And besides that, I have seen that it is not enough to stop using drugs, but more so, it is important to have a personality change.
Mm.
Or personality reformation or modification. Why I say this is that I've seen in my section, in my counseling section, that people have stopped using drugs for years but exhibit their addictive behavior or attitude. You know, and so people are in recovery but they are still not bathing.
Okay.
They are still not brushing their teeth.
Okay.
They still come in late for counseling. They still have the I want to fight attitude when they have to resort to dialogue and other things like that. So
that would go in for the indicators, right?
Yes. Mm. So there's something we call dry drunk or dry drinking or dry dragging. You are not drinking or dragging. You are dry, but your attitude is actually showing almost like somebody who is still drinking or dragging.
Dry drinking or dry dragging. Oh, okay. Okay.
So it's very important to have a personality change, and I believe that it's helped me. Along the line, I found an addictive diseases unit of the Kolobo Teaching Hospital.
Well, before we get to that, did you tell your parents, did you tell your mom, did you tell your church, did you expose anything to them that you were using drugs when you started fellowshipping, when you were going to church and all that?
Well, I couldn't tell my story to the world when I was using, although it was obvious that I was using, you know.
Did anyone ever ask you whether you are using? Did anyone ever meet you and say,
A few did, especially for those I knew before I started using drugs, like my classmates and stuff like that. What has come over you? What is happening? Some of them felt that I was sick and so on. But others too were told, so they knew that I was on drugs.
What were your reactions?
Well, I was always in denial. No. I was always in denial. I would justify and rationalize and all of that. You know, if I was confronted over a particular situation, I would justify why I did X, Y, Z. You know, I would rationalize. I was always in denial. I always wanted to blame shift. Blame other people for my predicament and so on and so forth. So it didn't come that easy. As I speak to you now, I'm sure that 11 years back, I wouldn't have been able to grant this interview. Yes.
So 11 years starting, when did treatment start? When did you start weaning yourself off it?
Well,
after the church?
It was after the sickness. I had fallen sick. And after I had a dream, after I came to that realization that I was going to die through the information I had in the dream, that if I didn't stop, I was going to die. That was when I realized that something had to be done. And then I critically took stock of myself, where I was, where I had found myself, comparing it to my mates, my classmates, and my colleagues, where they were at the time. And I realized that I was running at a loss. And so something needed to be done about the situation. So all these and every program I had, like the church going, I was so committed to it. I put in my all. It wasn't as if I was doing it half and half. You know, I was soaked in the church's activity, right? And then I found ADU. Now, when I found ADU,
ADU is
Addictive Diseases Unit in Kolobo.
Okay.
When I found ADU, I had started my advocacy. I was in the schools, I was in churches, I was telling about my story and then teaching somehow, some way on addiction. I didn't have much information on addiction like I do now.
And you had not quit the drugs for a long while.
Yeah.
But you still wanted to...
Yeah, I still wanted people to know about what is happening in the drug world. Because at a point, I started this time developing hatred for drugs. Just as I loved drugs, there was a paradigm shift.
Okay.
You know, I started developing hatred this time around for drugs, rather. I hated drugs so much and I still hate drugs so much that at any point in time, I want to talk about the negativity or the negative aspect of drug use. So I kept going to the schools, telling them about drugs, kept going to the churches, sharing my story and so on. Then I found ADU and that was when I learned drug addiction management proper.
Okay.
And as I speak now, I had been or have been with ADU for 7 years, peer counseling, because I understudied addiction in ADU. And then now I teach and I counsel, I do training programs, I speak in churches, I speak in schools, I honor invitations to speak to in conferences.
And you are proud of that?
Yes, I'm proud of that. I travel, you know, to speak in other countries and so on. I'm so proud of that. I believe that...
You do want to do drugs?
As I speak to you now, somebody asked me on one of the interviews I granted in one of the radio stations that don't I believe that even at least small oneself, I don't do. I can tell you with all honesty that I don't drink any kind or form of alcohol to the extent that I'm particular with communion wine that is served in the church. I don't drink, I don't smoke, I'm not into anything. In fact, if there's anything I do, I drink water.
Do you think it could be a weakness?
And some people have seen or found it to be a weakness, especially for those friends or those colleagues, using colleagues on the street. I share this with them and they are like, are you normal? Because for them, a man must look like a man and a man's mouth must smell like a man. You know, so if you are not smelling or blowing fuse, like we say in our world, then you are not a man enough. But I feel that you need to be original, you know. As a human being, you need to be original. You don't have to be have, you know, that kind of, what we say, lawyer for somewhere or somehow to be able to assist you to do anything.
Are you therefore saying that the society, there are a lot of adverts on TV and radio saying, if you don't drink this, you are not a man. Excuse me. If you don't drink, you are not a man. You can't approach women. You can't do that and all that. There are lots of adverts.
You see, the adverts on our TV are so attractive. Mm. I watch adverts. Sometimes I'm glued to my TV just to watch adverts on alcohol. Quite interesting. But let me tell you, they are doing their business. We can't stop them from doing their businesses. I mean, they would have to go on with their business. I mean, if the government is not stopping them, who are we to stop them with their businesses? Mm. But there's one thing we can do.
And what they
we
say
have
the
to
adverts
see
are not
the adverts they are doing as a way of deceiving all of us to get into drinking.
Oh, really?
Why would they not use somebody who is an addict, somebody who is emaciated, help me with the adjectives, somebody who is gone down the drain with alcohol and other drugs for the advert?
But they say drink responsibly.
Well, that is the naive part, that is the ignorant part of the advert. Now, when you say drink responsibly, the idea I get is that don't drink too much. Isn't it? Now, if you say don't drink too much, you aren't communicating anything. Because you see, the quantity of alcohol one takes does not determine, you know, whether the person is or will end up being an alcoholic or not. Let me tell you
this. Come back again there.
So the quantity,
it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter the quantity you take. Mm-hmm. An alcoholic is an alcoholic.
It doesn't matter. Okay,
it doesn't matter
weekly or...
Now, let me take you through this education, this psychoeducation. There's always a time of experimentation through what we see on TV, right? So sometimes some of us or some people are so curious, they want to find out what it tastes like to drink. So the first time you drink, it's not planned, but sometimes, like I said, you are offered for free, you want to try it. Two things will happen when you try or experiment. You either will enjoy it or you suffer it. And for those who suffer it by having the dizziness, the vomit and stuff like that, are fortunate and are likely not to continue drinking any longer. But those who will enjoy it, the euphoria, you know, are likely to come back and say, this time not being offered, but they go for it.
Mm.
Just to feel or have the same experience they had the first time they drank.
Okay.
And when this happens, there's the possibility of revisitation. And when that happens, you see, you've moved on from experimentation to recreation.
Okay.
So the recreation, you are jamming.
So that is for those who enjoyed it.
Who enjoyed it. It gave them a sense of euphoria and addressed a long time or long standing, you know, problem. For example, if they didn't have the confidence to propose to women, this time the alcohol is doing the wonders, giving them the ability to speak to women and stuff like that. That's why you hear people say, I'm going to drink and come and speak my mind. So they move on to the stage of recreation, and this time they are still jamming. And to the extent that people even say, hey Charlie, this time you they have fun, I'm having fun, you know.
Chilling.
And they tell a whole sort of things about what they drank and the quantity they took in and stuff like that. Now they get to a point where now people begin to prompt them that, look, now your drinking thing is becoming too much. Now when you get to that point where people begin to prompt you, then now it means that you've gotten on to the stage of abuse. That's why they say drug abuse.
Okay.
At that time, you have a lot of people coming in to advise you to stop drinking.
Mm.
And if you don't adhere to those information or those people trying to communicate to you and get you to stop, you cross that thin line, which I call the red thin line.
Okay.
And then now you move on to the stage of addiction or alcoholism. Now you are at the stage of addiction. At the stage of addiction, it's not only the euphoria that is getting you to go drink or drug. Now, it is your body system is now adopted or hooked to the use of the drug. So, without the drugs, you can't operate. You can't live.
Hmm.
You understand? The drugs have become like a petrol and car. Without the petrol, the car cannot move. You know? So, at a point, it's not only for enjoyment.
Hmm.
You need to drink or drug to survive. Because if you refuse to do, then it means that you are likely to die.
Okay.
And the fear of death through the withdrawal is what gets people to continue to drink and continue to drag.
So, meaning at that point, you may not even be taking much, just a little?
Yes, just a little. In fact, at the stage of addiction, a lot of people don't even take much. you know, in one of the sections we're having, even today, before we had this interview, I asked a gentleman how many thoughts he takes in a day. A typical addict, he said two thoughts. And I'm like, ah, two thoughts?
At that stage.
At that stage. Mm. And all you and I know that two thoughts cannot even move a beginner, you know. So when you rise to the stage of addiction, it's not the quantity. Mm. So if you say drink responsibly, and you are getting me to think that when I don't drink a lot, then I'm cool. And that when I drink a lot, that is where the problem is. You are not communicating anything.
Very well. Mm. Very well. So how do we, as parents, as friends, and how do we identify that someone is having a problem with drugs, someone is addicted, someone needs help with drugs?
Yes, there are so many things. I've mentioned a few. I've mentioned the withdrawal. And these withdrawals are seen or felt by the user.
Mm.
You know, normally you don't see. When the user has headache, you don't feel it, but he feels it. You know, so these are the internal things that happen, that the user himself comes to that point. When he's very honest with himself, you know that he's got into a state of addiction. But there are a few things you see, you know, as parents and other things like that, that should prompt you that your child has or might have started using drugs.
Okay.
And I'm going to share a few, so that if you see about 2, 3, 4 or some of these things, you know, occurring in the life of your child, it should give you a clue that it is possible that he started using. First of all, when you see that there's change in dressing, perhaps your son is the neat looking guy like I used to be, but this time his dressing has changed. He's committed to wearing certain ivory colors, you know, change in dressing. It should send an information to you. It should be able to prompt you, right? And changing friends, strange friends. Now you realize that the friends he's moving with, you know, you can't, strange friends. He comes home with strange friends. Some, you look at them, you realize that this one, no, right? Changing friends. And normally they're not able to keep friends for very long time. They change friends frequently, and that should give you a clue. Now, when you realize that your child loses interest in his original hobby, maybe he likes playing spar, drafts, computer game, something, but this time he doesn't have time for those things. That is also a clue. When there's a decline in academic performance, it should send a clue. When his performance drops drastically, it should send a clue that perhaps he started using drugs. Now, when his sleeping patterns changes, when I talk about sleeping patterns, I'm talking about sleeping late and getting up late. When roughly by the time, by 8, 9 p.m. he's asleep, this time he sleeps around midnight, and then gets up very late, 9, 10, he's still in bed.
Okay.
It should send a signal. When his eating pattern changes,
okay,
it should also send a clue.
Now, he's eating more or he's eating less?
Yes, either eating more or eating less. Now, when you're using a drug like marijuana is a psychedelic drug.
Okay.
When you say psychedelic drug, it doesn't have one reaction. You know, it's either stimulant or depressant.
Okay.
You know, like in my case, marijuana, most of the time when you're using, they say when you eat, you smoke marijuana, you eat a lot. But in my case, I wasn't able to eat a lot. I couldn't eat half ball of a kinky.
Okay.
Yeah, so a change in eating pattern. And then when you also see isolation, now this time he's not mingling with the family. He comes, and formally he can come and sit down, watch TV with the family and stuff, but this time he comes from town straight into his room.
Okay.
It must send a signal to you that possibly he started. When something happens at home and you see that he's supposed to be responsible and he's shifting blames, it should also send a signal. Rationalization and justifications are also ways of identifying the drug addict. Now, when he has no respect for personal hygiene, he does things anyhow this time. He eats, he doesn't bother to wash the bowls, he doesn't wash his clothes any longer. His personal hygiene must also send a clue. Now, when is, I've mentioned about not being able to keep friends and so on and so forth. Now, when you see about 2, 3, 4, you know, some of these things surfacing, then it should be able to send that signal to you that something may be happening.
Okay.
And then most of the time, parents ignore these particular things, thinking that, oh, it's a phase, it will pass.
Mm.
But nothing happens for nothing. When you realize or identify that these things are happening in the life of your child, you need to take steps to find out further what is happening. That's what I recommend, occasional search.
Okay.
Occasionally get into his room in his absence, search his pockets, under the pillow, you'll find matches, boxes, and find out the content of
those. Could come in for the interventions from parents and things, but I'll go to my Facebook wall, and I posted about our interview, and we have some few responses. We had some responses coming in from Antonia Fesu. She wanted to know how it did start, and like you have earlier stated that you are so curious about it. We have Dr. Sel Botre, who wanted to know at what point you decided to stop. I think
when I was gradually dying.
Or better still, what pushed you to stop it? And then Felix Amate Amanate wants to know whether you have developed any complication as a result of the substance abuse, and I think it's now, like presently.
Have you developed? You know, I always talk to you about this, my ulcer thing. Yes, I have ulcer. I'm struggling with ulcer one way or the other. It's better now.
Okay.
It's better now, and I think that is as a result of the use of all these drugs, especially alcohol. Those are some of the complications.
Okay, and Isaac Ewa is also a strong advocate for mental health. He also was asking, what do you do for relapse prevention?
You know, relapse prevention, it's a very important thing to ask and to know, you know, because you can, addiction is, that's why we say one does not recover from addiction. Addiction, as I speak to you now, I'm a recovering addict.
Okay.
That means that every single day of my life, I need to recognize that I have a problem with drugs.
Okay.
Right? That is the first thing that every single addict must know, or recovering addict must know. You know, I can't use drugs in any way or in any form and survive. Right? But one of the tools you can use to fight addiction or you know, escape from relapse has to do with reporting your cravings.
Okay.
The cravings,
report
your cravings to people who wouldn't want you to use drugs.
Oh, okay.
Addiction dwells in secrecy.
Okay.
Addiction grows in secrecy. Now, when you expose addiction, right, you free yourself from its hook.
Yeah.
Right. So the best as a counselor, as an advocate, what we always advice is that report your cravings. If you feel like drinking, if you feel like smoking, tell the next person who wouldn't want you to use.
Do you do that?
I do most often.
Okay.
I do.
Okay.
And as I speak to you now, I believe that I'm getting beyond recall, but I'm not complacent.
I do.
And I think that is just like a thief who gets to, let's say, a bank and stands in front of the bank and calls the police that I'm about to break into the banking hall to steal. Most definitely he will not succeed in stealing.
Sure.
It's the same way. If you're about to drink and you call the next person who wouldn't want you to drink, it means that there's a possibility of not drinking.
That's,
you know, so
of craving.
So that is a strong weapon to fight addiction or fight relapses.
Okay. You wanted to know what were your drug choice. I think you have made mention.
Yes, mention. Heroin was my apparently I loved all.
Yeah.
But I loved heroin the most.
Okay. And he wants to know, and you in your advocacy and your counseling, are there AA and NA groups? And AA groups, I'm sure he was referring to Alcohol Anonymous.
Yeah.
And Narcotic Anonymous. Narcotic. Do we have such groups in Ghana?
Yeah, we have a few AA and NA groups in Ghana. One is held in Kolebu Addictive Diseases Unit, ADU. And we have a few out there.
Are there supports? He continues to ask whether there are supports available for family members.
Well, we have one other group.
Okay.
And we don't have much such things in our system in Ghana. We are trying to develop. As I speak to you now, I'm trying to go into that area, but I can't do everything at the same time, you know. So those out there who have a way of also coming on board to support, why not?
We do it.
We are working together and we want a solution, so they are welcome to be
advocate
and see how best to be able to help parents who are struggling in their closet with their kids on drugs.
His other addition to the question is what I want to ask you personally. Did your family suffer any great deal due to your drug addiction?
My family went sick. You know, I was sick. Addiction is said that the user, having gotten to the stage of addiction, is sick. But unfortunately, the family of the user also goes sick. You know, so my family was sick. So that's why in our section, our counseling section, what we do is that we don't only rehabilitate the user, the parents or the family must also be rehabilitated.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So my family was sick as well, but thank God you are healthy today.
Because
or they are recovering, let me put it that way.
Very well, because you are also very healthy. And I must, let me say, I've been speaking with one fine gentleman who is bent on helping people get out of addiction. He is working tirelessly around the clock, and he managed to give me, spend some time with me, and he tells me of how he managed to move away his 19 years in the ghettos and the streets where he has earned his PhD. I'm yet to see your certificate.
You are seeing it. I'm exhibiting my certificate now.
Unfortunately, he has found help, and for the past 11 years he has been sober and he's off it. He runs his NGO. He'll be telling us something about it, and after he helps us with what interventions that parents, what interventions should the society, what intervention should the government be doing so that we save the lives of people who are gradually drawing into hell. He runs his NGO, the Openness, and then they take it's a step-by-step recovery program to help people achieve a higher power so that they eventually will move out of drug addiction. He has been going around institutions, he has been granting counseling sessions to people, and I think he's doing a very marvelous job, and he will need your support. If you have any problem after this, we'll be leaving contacts behind that you can get in touch with Mr. Opari. So let's get to interventions as we wrap up here. What interventions are there? What can we do as a family, as a society, as the government?
First of all, let me take the family. A lot of families actually contribute to the use, their children's use of drugs. In other words, they fuel their use of drugs. And one way they do that unknowingly or enable them is when they themselves are unaware. If they are unaware, and I think that this interview is going to help a lot, because we've given the identification, how to identify the addict. So if you are ignorant and you are not aware, it's a way of fueling or enabling your child to continue to use drugs, right? Because you are not aware of the situation. Now, two, if they are aware, some people come to know, they understand, it's quite obvious this time by virtue of what we are even sharing now, that their children are using drugs, but they feel that it's a phase, it will pass. You know, it will, it will pass. That is how the father used to be. That is how the grandfather used to be. So they think that it will pass. And that is also a way of fueling the use of the drugs. Now, the third one I want to talk about is where parents are powerless. If parents are powerless, in other words, if the means are not there, if they don't know the right place to go, and so on and so forth, that can also create a problem and can be a way of fueling drug use. And then the next thing I want to talk about, if parents themselves are on drugs, because there are parents who are drinking. And then, so if you are drinking and you have a mini bar in your house and your child chooses to use marijuana and you say that, stop smoking, you haven't done anything, because you know, these are children, computer age, they are smart, they feel that if you are drinking, why can't I smoke? You understand? So much as we are thinking about interventions and getting parents how they will get help and other things like that, I think the first thing that has to be done is for parents to themselves check what they do at home, right? And then in Ghana, in Accra, we have ADU, Addictive Diseases Unit. And then, like you've rightly said, some numbers will be left for openness to be contacted. We'll direct you. We've not started our rehab yet, but we do advocacy. Why not, if you want to invite
now
us?
Does Ghana have some rehab centers?
We have a few. You know, we have a few. It's not enough. We have just a few. So we are gradually coming up. You know, it's not as if the situation is hopeless, but I think that we need to do more
than that. I think we would need more, because when I look at the numbers each day we are recording of persons with addictive diseases, you can have an average, even with the addictive disease unit alone, in a day we're having about three people reporting all around the year. Three people are coming each day, and those who are hiding in secrecy and are not coming, then definitely we will need more rehab.
Mr. Blade, this year, June 26th, World Drugs Day, I was made to be on a show, a TV show, a TV breakfast show,
yeah.
And it was very early in the morning. I was supposed to get there around 7, but I left the house very early, and I went through some few ghettos before going to the TV station. And then what I saw, I was in fact, I do that frequently. I visit the ghettos, you know, but this time I wanted to have a feel of the current situation in the ghetto before going on the TV show. And what I saw, I was so flabbergasted. In the sense that, you know, the number of people I saw, in fact, when I was on drugs and I was coming out of drugs, the number of people on drugs then compared to what I saw the day, it was so amazing. The number has quadrupled.
What kind of people are there? What?
People from all walks of life, graduates, down to truck pushers, you know, clergies, and don't be amazed.
Really?
You know, yes, clergies, women and men. This time the women are even rubbing shoulders with the men in the ghettos.
What,
you know,
men can do.
Yeah, women can do, and they're even doing it better. They're even doing it better. And the age group, in fact, from 13-14 on hard drugs.
What? 13-14?
13-14.
Yes.
Yes. 13 years on hard drugs. And I'm not exaggerating. I'm not making it up. I'm telling you something from what I saw and what I'm still seeing on the street. 13-14 years are on drugs. You understand? So the situation, I don't know. I don't know whether I will say that we are still having a challenge or we have gotten to the crisis stage already.
So what can society and the government then do?
We should all come on board. We should all come on board. There are people out there who cannot actually do the advocacy we are doing now. You know, Mr. Blair, you know, you have been with me, you've known me for some time now, and you know how we struggle to get out there even with our advocacy work, you know. So we should all come on board. Those who cannot go and do what we are doing should support us. That is what I believe in. I'm not asking for this because we want to enrich ourselves with whatever they want to support us with, with public addressing systems and with vehicles, cars, and, you know, something to get us mobile, to get us moving.
Okay.
Because some of us, we are doing this advocacy, or the job we are doing is
non-funded.
Yes. Yeah. And besides that, it is it's not a part-time something. It's a full-time job.
Okay.
You understand?
Yeah.
It's a full-time thing we are doing.
Okay.
So, of course, if we are doing this full-time, then there must be somebody somewhere to assist in what we are doing.
Okay.
We are not asking for the whole world. We are asking that if you have that car in your garage, which you may not be using for now, please let us have it. Yes. Somebody, it doesn't matter the condition in which the car is. Please let us have it. We'll fix it and use it.
For mobility.
Yes. Because, look, we have been in Accra. And slightly beyond Accra, but when you go to the interland, the situation is worse. You understand? We haven't gotten there yet. People in other parts of Ghana do not understand, having heard what we are doing. They need what we are doing. They need reformation. They need rehabilitation. We are saying that if you have a house, you are not using yet, please, we are not saying dash us, give us for us to start with our rehabilitation work. We'll give it back to you if you want it.
Very well. So what then should we expect from the government?
Yeah, government needs to inject more support.
Do you think there are some policies that need to be reviewed? Do you think some things need to, we have to impose some laws?
I believe that the policymakers do not know what is happening on the ground.
They don't.
That is
understand.
My belief. I may be wrong. They do not understand the situation. They do not understand the situation. I'm yet to find one policymaker tell me that he's visited the ghetto. There might be one or two. But I'm saying that, to me,
he has visited to take a piece.
Ah, perhaps. Perhaps. That is just a joke anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't underrate or underestimate anybody this time around.
Yeah.
In fact, people are doing things in their closet.
Yeah.
But what we are saying is that the government should come on board. You know, if we want investors, for example, I'm not an economist, but my little economist tells me that investors look for so many things. They want to see whether, among other economic things, they want to see like power and other things like that. They want to see whether the crime rate in your country is normal,
very well.
or is at the barest minimum.
Yeah.
You know, and I can tell you, I have been in the ghetto, I know what is happening. About 99.9% of the criminals on our street are robbers, pickpockets, and all of them are on drugs. Because it is very abnormal to pull a gun on somebody when you are not induced, drug induced. You know, so we government should come on board, you know, support. Because when we are asking for individual support, there are individuals who say, but what about the government? So if individuals are ready to, you know, throw in their support, then we need more support from the government.
Okay.
So government should come on board. Let's find out what all of us can do in order to ease. We are not saying or promising eradication. No. But at least we can reduce the situation.
Very well. Very well. So it's step by step, and we'll get there, and we can reduce the situation. My guest has been Richard Opari. He is the CEO of Openest. And Openest, it's an NGO. I understand that that it is a non-funded, non-denominational. You have been surviving. You have been bootstrapping. They have been doing it all by themselves. And then I happened to chance on Mr. Opari due to his work he has been doing. And I think such persons in the society who have been there and wouldn't want others to be, wouldn't want that's your relative, that's your brother, that's your husband, that's your friend, that's your family person, that significant person of the society also be there. The society can ever and ever be a better place to live in if we can do our little bit. So just in case you need help for rehabilitation or talk on drug abuse, addiction in your church, mosque, school, youth campaigns, etc. You can keep this number and call 0244-152-077, 0244-152-077, or 0261-54-077, or you can send your email to openest@yahoo.com. Just in
openest
case,
spelled
O-P-A-N-E-S-T. So just in case you need help with drug abuse, drug addiction, our society can't crumble, can't go on its knees.
And these numbers are for Openest.
Okay.
So when you call, I mean, it comes to me.
Okay.
And then we can talk further and see the way forward.
Very well. Very well. So what will be your last message to someone who is now having a problem with drug?
Like somebody said to me, and I found that to be very inspiring, is it take nothing for granted.
Okay.
Every situation in which you find yourself, more especially those who are using drugs and are listening to this interview, don't take the situation in which you find yourself now for granted. Because the end result of drug use is death.
Okay.
Now, when you find a rehab, don't take the rehab and whatever they do there to help you for granted. Right? If you are a parent listening to this interview, do not take the upbringing of your child or your children for granted. Be very circumspect and be particular with every single step they take. Right? Because drugs have come to stay with us. Right? Drugs have come to stay with us. But the only thing or the only way out is to be able to understand the dangers and do something about the situation.
And to those experimenting, taking the thought, saying, I drink only once in a month. I drink occasionally.
And nobody starts using alcohol or drugs and then becomes an addict one day. It's a gradual thing. It's a progressive thing. So once you feel that, oh, this one is nothing, small, just for fufu, small, just for bankun, gradually you are getting there. And then you will not know when you get there. You don't know what your body system is and how and when you are going to get there. But gradually, it's a progressive thing. You want to get there. But I believe that if you don't want to get there, that it's important you stop now.
Thank you very much, Mr. Opari. And I will sum it up to say, drugs, alcohol are dangerous. Desist from it. Thank you very much for listening. And join me once again in our next episode on Health Talks. This has been Kobe Blay for Ghana Healthness.